Oh, listeners, you're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we're going to be talking to a comrade, not a comrade, a fellow British person, Peter.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it's Tim Stadleton. Right, Tim? Or you pronounce it?
Correct. That's it. You got
okay. And your restaurant is called Padella, and it's in my most favorite place, Borough Market, and it's subtitled Iconic Pasta at Home. Now, Padella, you say, means pan.
It does,
yes. Is it a kind of pan? Is it a kind of pan?
Well, no, padella just translates in Italian to pan. In Italian, okay. It translates, sorry, to English, to pan. And so, yeah, it's important for us because the kind of pasta we do and to try and make kick-ass pasta, it's important that you understand what's going on in the pan. We do one dish per pan, so we serve maybe 600 people a day. Every pasta goes through one pan, and you've got to mix it in the pan, make sure it all comes together to get a perfect sort of sauce that we're after. So we called the restaurant Padella because of that reason.
Well, Tim, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that this book is actually going to be everybody's go-to book on making pasta. I mean, it's a very impressive book, and I love it, love it. And it's beautifully produced.
That's fine to say.
It's what?
Very kind of you to say that. Thank you.
Oh, no, not kind. It's real. I mean, it's a fabulous book. And I feel we have so many connections. We love most of the restaurant people in London anyhow. And I see you have comments by a number of them praising your book. Including our dear friend, of course, Jeremy, who we love. I'm going to say something, is that you are not Italian, but you totally have absorbed the Italian culture of food and cooking and entertaining and camaraderie. And I appreciate that a lot. My background is Sicilian. And you love Naples, actually, right?
I do love Naples. I think Naples is brilliantly bonkers. And it's funny, in Europe, I would say, when I go to Naples, I feel like I'm not in Europe anymore. It's got this mad vibe about it. It's chaos. It's kind of edgy. It's a bit dangerous, but the people, the spirit of that region, and specifically Naples, it's you can't help but get absorbed into it all. And once you settle and simmer down with the frequency of it, and just take it on, it's a wonderful place.
Yeah,
I tell you the truth. I was surprised I made it out alive.
I didn't catch that. I'm sorry. I didn't hear that.
Okay, let me do it again. When I go to Naples, I worry that I'm going to die.
he's talking about trying to drive in Naples. Well, you know what that's like, Tim.
I mean, if you can,
one
I'll tell
trip
you something.
We end up in the police station.
I mean, absolutely. If you can drive in Naples, you can drive anywhere, is my view. There's no rhyme or reason. There's certainly no rules. Some people think Naples is a dangerous place. And don't get me wrong, I'm sure people have had some dangerous times there. But my experience is that the people are friendly. If you take it on and absorb yourself into it, they're pretty friendly when it comes down to it. And my own mind, the food is outstanding.
Well, you know, there's so many points of contact with you and your background and your interests. We've eaten at 15, by the way. Well, I mean, the last time we saw Jamie Oliver was actually in Borough Market. We've always hung out at Borough Market when we were in London. And the places in Italy, and then the tips you've picked up on what it's like being an Italian and eating and cooking in the Italian way is so familiar to us. It was a joy reading your book, and I think that that's something that some of your attributes mentioned. It's a joyful book, and you should be very happy about that.
Well, yeah, I am, actually, and thank you for noting that. Look, I find it a privilege that I get to do what I do, to be a chef, to work in restaurants, you know, to earn a crust through doing that is a real privilege. And the reason why is because not only do I love cooking, but I feel that having restaurants and creating a space for people to have their happy time in life, and when they choose to spend their disposable income and come and have that happy time with us, I find that an honor. And so, you know, we get to do that lunch and dinner every day. I mean, you know, come on, that's a great way to make a living, and it fills me with joy on a regular basis. And so putting it into a book, similarly, you know, on a, you know, at home, to be able to cook for family, friends, or just even yourself, have that moment, take a, you know, second to you know, to connect, I think is a joyous thing. And pasta for me is the most democratic food that there is. And so, yeah, I'm pleased you felt that, and you read that from the book, because that's how I genuinely feel in life.
How do you feel about the environment that you're in when most people in Italy would not be taking on the challenge of creating a wonderful eating situation in a foreign country?
Sorry, can you say that again?
Sure. Why do you think Jamie Oliver has been so successful, and the activities that he's involved in with food, whether it's publishing or just dealing with the written word itself? Why do you think you've been so successful?
Then he means he's questioning the fact you're not Italian, and nor is Jamie Oliver.
Yeah. I think you know. Look, I don't. Look, Jamie is in a different league. So, like, you know, I can't talk for him, but I can certainly talk for myself. And I would say, just bear with me one second. For myself, I think people with pasta, they're already connected to it. You know, you don't have to be Italian to enjoy pasta. And when I talked about, you know, it being the most democratic food, for me anyway, from my point of view, it's the most democratic food. In the Western world, people are used to it. So you don't even have to go to Italy to go. You've probably got a connection with it. My experience with people, when you talk to them about food, that even if they're not into food and they're into restaurants and cooking, if you ask them what's in your top three dishes, nearly always a pasta dish comes into it. So there's nostalgia there already for people. Now, also with Italian food, I just think it's got, you know, when you ask people about Italy, you know, what comes to mind straight away? nearly always, I think people would say something about food. They'll say pizza, they'll say pasta, or they'll say the wine, or something around that region. They don't say that about other countries, necessarily. And I think, so, we, I fell in love with Italian food. It's my compass when it comes to cooking. And I think that other people just get that as well. They feel it. And so once you spend your, I spent my career sort of dedicating myself to learning how to, to cook with the same principles as what Italians have taught me. And so people feel that and they get it. So I don't think there's any major, there's nothing special about, what I've done. It's nothing that, it's not that I invented anything. It's more I've dedicated a lot of time to bringing, that sort of enthusiasm, attention to detail and passion, and I put it into a format, into a place that people don't normally feel that. And so I think that's what it is. I hope that's answered the question, because it's a good question, but it's quite difficult to pin that down.
No, did I misread this? My understanding of the concept of 15 is that it was for young people who were not sure of their direction in terms of career and profession. But I read that. Did I misread that your father owned pizza shops?
No. You absolutely that's true. Both parts of that. Look, 15 was a wonderful. Sadly, it's no longer. But it was a. Jamie created something very special. Every year, I was the first intake in 2002. Every year he would take on 15 students to work at 15, and you've been there, so you know what that's what the restaurant looked like. Of young people from different backgrounds, from disadvantaged backgrounds, of and using the power of food and restaurants to give them a platform. And that certainly was the case for me. I left school at 16 years old. I didn't know what I was going to be doing. My friends were all going off to university or knew the direction they were going in at that young age. And I was slightly lost. And so, cooking, working in restaurants, being a chef, totally transformed my life at that time and then put me on the track to where I am now. Yeah, my father also owned pizzerias, and so I was used to being, I didn't grow up thinking I wanted to be a chef, probably because I grew up around in restaurants going, I don't want to do this, and maybe a bit of, I wasn't massive, I think maybe just at that young age is a bit like, I don't want to do what my dad does, just because I was young and I didn't know what I was doing, but yeah, both are true.
Well, you picked the right thing because you, right off the get-go, you were, every venture you were involved in was a success, and your current restaurant is people line up around the block to get into. So you picked the right profession. I want to mention you have a really important thing that a lot of people don't understand in your chapter, your section on the method. Because people just think they put a pot of water on and stick the dried pasta in it and time it, and that's it. And you have this whole chapter on, or a section of the book, on the method. You go through sofrito, pasta water, mantecatura, spadolare, melting parmesan. Talk to us, our listeners, a little bit about this. Start with sofrito. Mm. Which I think most people probably skip when they're doing pasta.
Mm. So, yeah, the method section is, if you're going to get the book, I highly recommend you read the method section because it's the key, I would say, to transforming you. I think most of your listeners will already be cooking pasta. and they'll probably be doing a pretty good job. If you want to elevate it, then read the method section. And sofrito is one of the parts of the method section. And sofrito is just a word for, you know, in French it's called mirepoix. English, we don't have a word for it. It's the foundation. So a lot of European cooking, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners know this, but it tends to be carrot, onion, celery, the holy trinity in European cuisine. In saying that, you know, in Asian cooking, it could be something completely different, like ginger, chili, and dried shrimp, right? It is essentially, sofrito is the foundation of your cooking when you're doing a ragu, for example. So the key here, though, is that you cook it down and you focus. It doesn't take a lot of focus, but just consider what's going on. Take onion, carrot, celery, and cook it down for half an hour, maybe even a little bit longer, to where it goes sweet and the natural sugars start coming out and it gets a bit sticky, it changes color, and it breaks down a bit, and you get little smudgy parts at the bottom of the pan that you want to maybe add a splash of water to rub that off. That is like a natural, that little smudginess at the bottom where it's got sticky is a natural form of a stock cube. And so if you concentrate on that part and get that sort of that magic sort of 30-minute mark of getting the sofrito to a wonderful place, you're on solid foundations to create a wonderful sauce. And so that's what I go into with when you get into, you know, that is the sofrito method that I talk about. You don't need it for everything, but certainly for slow-cooked ragus, it will serve you well to follow that, and it will change, you know, the end game.
Now, the same could be said with pasta water. The most people pay attention to is that you add a little bit of that when you're stirring up your pasta. You have a lot more information about pasta water. Tell our listeners about that.
Absolutely. Another, like, well, I would say the key to making a lot of good pastas is when your pasta is cooked, don't throw that pasta water away. So get a colander over a bowl, use a mug to maybe get some water out. But that starchy water, when you put the pasta in, it's clear water. Once it's done, you're going to find it's gone a bit murky. And that's the goodness that you're after. And important is to say you must season the pasta water and make it taste like mild seawater. So it's a decent amount of salt that needs to go in there. And remember that not all of that salt's going to go into the pasta, so don't worry when you go. You know, I often have people tell me, oh, my goodness, that's a lot of salt. But it's not all going in. But it's very important to season the water to season the pasta. But then when you are keeping that pasta water at the end, again, with a ragu maybe, or even with a filled pasta, say a simple ravioli of ricotta and have it with sage and butter. If you want to have a lovely silky sauce with that, you need the pasta water to bring it together. So, you know, you don't want a dry pasta. You know, I talk a lot about having a pasta on the plate with a small halo of sauce around it. And often use a slow-moving lava field as an example. You won't get that unless you keep the pasta water. A lot of recipes in the book, you'll hear me say, add a few splashes of the pasta water to bring the sauce, to bring the pasta and whatever the ragu or the sauce is, you know, to bring it together. So it's vital that you keep hold of that. So don't put it down the sink until you're ready.
Yeah, now there's also a lot of confusion around dried versus fresh pasta. Can you address that?
Well, I hope the book would explain that there shouldn't be confusion and treat them as separate entities. Love them both. Treat them like you would your, you know, your children or your siblings. You know, they're different things, but they're wonderful. They're wonderful at the same time. Neither is better or worse.
I see. Well, that's good. A lot of people don't attempt fresh pasta, but anyhow, you say it's equal. You can use dried, and a lot of your recipes are for regular egg out of the package dried, right?
Yeah, correct. Look, I suppose I can expand this a lot more. Look, I think there's connotations because it's fresh pasta that it's better. That's not true. Pasta is the vehicle for the sauce. That's what it, you know, and the attention should be going into what sauce you're putting with it, and then that will govern what type of pasta should be going with it. For example, a spaghetti or linguine vongole needs to go with dry pasta because you need the bite, the al dente bite that you get from dry pasta that you just cannot get with fresh pasta. And that's just the nature of it. And the reason about that is that you want to have when you're chewing a clam with a harder bite linguine spaghetti dried pasta, you have a better mouthfeel. You have a better sensation going on. It's not bad with fresh tagliarini, but it's not as good. So that's why something like a dried pasta works perfectly there. Fresh pasta is more elegant. And it requires sometimes, for example, this time of year, and I'm only talking about it because last night we were talking about it at dinner. It's truffle season. Now, I don't expect listeners to be going out to buy truffle, but because it's crazy money. But we are in the epicenter of white truffle season in Europe, and we were talking about this last night. Going, it would still be good with dried spaghetti, but it's so much better with fresh tagliarini with egg yolk in it. It's just more elegant. It's a more regal version of it, and it just is what should be going on. It really depends on, as I said, it's the vehicle for the sauce. And I at home, I probably use dried pasta more because the reality is that I'm making fresh pasta a lot of, in my day job. So when I get home, it's just quick and easier to do it. In saying that, the weekends, I make a lot of filled pasta. And that's where the joy and the happiness, and I would say, is more fun. I look at making pasta as fun. It's like a game. It's like, when kids use Play-Doh. It's the same thing, just for growing up. And I would say that my kids, who are 4 and 8, also love doing it with me as well. So it's a nice way to spend, half an hour, and then they tend to eat it, which is good news.
Now, about 8 years ago, it might have been a little bit longer, we were staying overnight in a hotel, I think it was a Marriott hotel, in Bristol. And we had read about this restaurant, so we decided we must definitely go there. And they got as far up the chain as having 2 Michelin stars in a pasta restaurant in Bristol. The name, by the way, was Villanova, I think.
I don't remember that.
The two sons.
Oh, right.
Worked on their pasta cuisine. Sadly, one of them died rather young, which was kind of a shame because he was in a pretty good place.
Yeah.
And we're so sorry that we're not in the same good place, but But we'll use you instead, if that's all right.
Now, I mean, people generally understand now, when they never used to, that the pasta shapes and sauces have to be really related, well related to each other. And what factory did we go to in Italy where the guy was talking about how it used to be, they used to make X number of shapes, but now it's in the thousands. What was that?
It was like Baldassero or something like that. I mean, that wasn't it. But the name was somewhat similar to that.
Yeah.
And we stayed overnight with the man who owned the pasta factory. We went to dinner with him.
Was it Manicoretti? No, that's another thing.
It's probably, the restaurant's probably still there.
Yeah.
So if you look at.
Yeah, well, we were talking to the guy, I was mainly about the difference in production, hand production and bronze dyes and that kind of thing. But he mentioned how when he started, or his father or grandfather started, there were like a few shapes. And now there are thousands of shapes. Everybody wants their own shape.
Well,
now you like peachy.
Well, I think everyone likes peachy. And if they don't know it, and I hope that your listeners, if they get the book, they'll give it a go, because it's the, I would say, the easiest type of fresh pasta to make. The dough is very easy to bring together because it's just bread and water. It's just flour and water. It's as frugal as you'll get in terms of cooking. Then to roll it out, you don't need a machine to do it. You can just do it by hand. And peachy is a thick, like noodle, basically. Like an udon noodle, not dissimilar to that. And you roll it out similar size to like a breadstick. It takes maybe 5 or 6 minutes to cook. It's chewy. It's got a really nice bite to it. And it can go well with quite a lot of sauces. So I would say to your listeners that if anyone's feeling slightly overwhelmed or a bit, you know, like they don't feel like they can be bothered to make fresh pasta because it's a bit of a faff, I get that. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to get the machine. It costs like $80. I get it. Try this one, a peachy. You don't need anything for it. And then give it a go. And that would be typically putting your toe in the water to go, okay, you'll see how easy it is, how delicious it is. And then, you know, that will hopefully be the stepping stone to you then going, well, why don't I try to make pappardelle? And then after that, maybe, how about let's try and make ravioli? Peaches from sort of central Italy, sort of Umbria, Tuscany area. Highly recommend giving it a go, or at least when you see it. And then if you're in a restaurant, give it a taste, and you'll see what I'm talking about.
Yeah, now you have your own version of the peachy cacio e pepe. There's been comments about that. What do you do differently?
Well, so as you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, I'm not Italian, but I am inspired. It is my compass, and I respect the tradition. In saying that, because I'm British and I live in London, I do get a tiny bit of wriggle room. Cacio e pepe is a classic dish from Rome that is black pepper, pecorino cheese, and the pasta water that we were talking about a few moments ago. That is it. And you bring you melt the pecorino into the pasta water with lots of pepper. Wonderful dish. Now, my experience of going out to Italy over the past, you know, my adult life, so 20-odd years, is at first I was like, you have to do it exactly the same way as what, you know, they're doing. Because otherwise, you know, it's like, it's a sin. And as the years go on, I've realized that every Italian person that I've ever met has a different version of how to do something. And they argue amongst themselves about how to do something. They argue between families of going, well, actually, my uncle does a better version of it. And the uncle goes, my version is the right version. And then his sister will go, no, don't listen to him. This is how you do
it. My family's the same way.
Right? And so I was like, okay, interesting. You're allowed to have opinions. Italians, you know, as a nation, people, I get this all the time with people telling me, oh, a friend of mine came to your restaurant and they really loved it. They're Italian. And they you know, and they use that as a, like, if an Italian says it's good, it must be good. So it's, you know, there's a thing, if you're not Italian, to go, well, because Italians say it, that must be true. And it might, when it comes to food anyway. I've realized that's not true. I've realized it's okay to change lane. And when I was in Tuscany once, and I'm talking 15 years ago, I saw a lady put, a chef, put butter into her cacio e pepe. I said, what are you doing? Like, what's going on here? She was like, we're not in Rome. I can do what I like. And then I looked at her and I tasted it and I went, you know what, that's better. And she was like, there we go. So the long-winded answer to your question is that we add butter into ours, which I know it pisses a lot of people off in Rome, but yes. We're not in Rome.
Yeah, I mean, Rome wouldn't add butter, you're right.
They would not do it, and I know. And I say it in the book, and I talk about it. I make no bones about it. I am aware. So, you know, shoot me down, but that's what we did. I think it brings a bit of elegance to it that isn't there, and smoothness and silkiness, and I just prefer it that way.
But now, you know Massimo Bottura?
Yes,
you know Massimo Bottura?
I know who he is. I don't know him.
Okay, well, anyhow, he's had the same problem in Modena with his treatment of tortellini, you know, because any deviation from the tradition, all the old nonnas were complaining about his modifying the recipes or the dishes. But he now has a tortellini factory. He has a son with special needs, and he set up a tortellini factory for his son and all the son's friends with the same issue, or other young men with the same issue, or men and women, disabilities of some sort, where they make tortellini, and he's rigged it up so that everybody can do that. So anyhow,
wow.
He's a good guy. I never knew that, and I have a long history with Italian food, the duck, orange, and cinnamon are natural combination. And I never knew that was a natural combination.
Mm. Well, I suppose that's, duck à l'orange, the classic French dish from, you know, the sort of, it was very famous in sort of like the 70s and 80s. Sorry, again?
I didn't know it had cinnamon in it. Yeah. Well, that's interesting.
That is definitely, that's more a me thing. That's it's not like I went to Italy and tried that. That's more me. A lot of my recipes, and in the restaurant, in the book, are classic recipes, and then there's a lot that I've just, you know, I would say half of them I've created myself. So, and this is one of them. I've taken a Duck and Orange. They've been, you know, good partners for many, you know, like for in the cooking world for a long time. Duck and Orange is like the classic. Adding cinnamon into it is this time of year. It's got quite a festive feel to it, it's a mixture. I think I remember creating that dish. It was around Christmas time, and the Christmas tree was up. We had dried oranges on the, you know, like as part of the decoration, cinnamon as well, and yeah, we were making some duck one evening, and so the leftover of that meal, I made it like a duck cassoulet one night just at home. The leftover of that meal, I used the duck, the smells of the orange and the pine and the cinnamon. It just kind of all came to me, and I just added bits into it. Because I only had a little bit left over, I made it into a filling for agnolotti. That's where that dish came from.
Now, I mean, you go in your book through, you know, like just the most direct, simple pasta dishes, and then you go into the special occasion pasta. Are those mainly your creations, or are they variations on classical, or what? I mean, I'm looking at here squid ink tagliarini with lobster, tomato, capers, and parsley. Where did that come from?
We were on a vacation in Cornwall, southwest England.
Cornwall, that's where Peter's brother lives. We were there all the time. We've been to that restaurant, Jamie Oliver's restaurant near there.
Sadly, it's not there anymore. The 15, it was on the beach there. I forgot the name of the beach. Beautiful location. Anyway, right. Cornwall, for your listeners, if you've not been to Cornwall in southwest England, give it a go. It's a wonderful part of the world. Anyway, I was down there with my family and another family. My good buddy that we were down there with, he's like-minded in terms of he appreciates food, put it that way, and likes to cook, likes to eat. We went and bought some lobster that had just from a local fisherman, and we bought too much because we got overexcited, and we had a supper just of like barbecued lobster that evening, but because we bought too much because we're greedy, we had loads left over. So then created this dish the next day for lunch, and it went down well. And so I then off the back of that made it a bit more. I refined it. I concentrated on what, you know, how to make it better and better, and I would say, as you mentioned, there's a lot of dishes, and the majority of it is super simple, straightforward. You can get the ingredients from your local sort of, you know, store. But this special section is where it gets a little bit like, well, you've got to put a bit more effort in, and you've got to really want to make it. And this is one of it, because I would say it's probably for the more adventurous, I would say, in terms of, or the more curious cook, because you've got to make the squid ink tagliarini. You got to get squid ink, and that's not straightforward. You got to make the dough, not straight. You know, it's, you know, there's a bit of work there. And then the lobster. What really brings this together, and this didn't happen when we did it in Cornwall. It was just done off the back of it as of the leftovers. But making a stock out of the shells to create a wonderful, almost bisque-like stock really elevates the dish. The lobster ragu, as it is pretty straightforward, but all the components around it adds layer upon layer upon layer of flavor to then end up being a pretty magical dish. And we did it actually this week in New York for an event I did, because I'm in New York this week. And it's a really special, extravagant I would say a celebratory pasta dish. So, and it looks the bee's knees when you put it on the plate as well. So if you want to show off, this is the one.
Yeah, I'd like for somebody to show it off to me, and I'd happily eat it.
So, well, maybe one time like we're in Cornwall. Seeing that you've got our connection cool, maybe the stars will align and we'll do it.
We would be remiss if we did not mention you have, in addition to your flat pastas, that you have a whole section of filled pastas, which are interesting to me because there are certain versions of the filled pastas in every cuisine of the world, just about. And you have a whole section of them. I'm looking at one. I don't know what caramelle is. What is caramelle? But I'm looking at the
caramelle
recipe.
Caramelle translates to like sweeties or candy in America. It's a little like old classic bonbons, like candy. You know the shape of old sort of candy in the sweetie, in the candy wrapper. That's what it translates to, and that's what they look like on the plate. They're just a little sort of candy-shaped filled pasta. There's lots of different types of filled pasta in the world. Ravioli is obviously the famous one. That's in the book. Along with agnolotti, which is getting more, people are getting more recognized for that. And I just wanted to put one in, because there's so many out there that I could have gone with. But, caramel is, it's a bit of fun to do. I think probably because my kids like doing it as well. So I thought, when we put it on the menu at the restaurant, it looks wonderful on the plate. Guests always really enjoy it, and so I thought let's if I'm gonna have to distill fill pastas because you can't get everyone in there, this one got on the hit list. That was it.
Wow. Well, the one I'm looking at is the pork and rabbit. That's an unusual combination in itself. Your book is a great reference book, and it's also and not only just very informative on a basic level, but it's also very sophisticated in its more elaborate and unusual productions. I think that everybody's going to want to include this book in their kitchen library. And I want to mention that how beautifully illustrated it is. My favorite illustration of all is a photograph of the empty plate. So I'm ready to eat this rabbit. What about you? Yes?
I'll keep it a secret.
Really thank you for taking the time to talk to us about it. And I'm really happy to see somebody devoting so much time to the fine points of pasta, as opposed to just a big pile of stuff on a plate. And, I mean, portion is an issue, I think, between here and Italy as well. And I don't know, I'm trying to remember, what about England? Do they like big plates also, Rabbit?
I'm afraid, sadly, they do.
Okay, the British like big plates of pasta as well, he said. So
they do. Annoyingly, but that's beginning to change, I think pasta has become over the past sort of 10 years or so in the UK, definitely in London anyway, people's perceptions changing a bit and getting to understand a different way to eat it, and I hopefully my book is adding to that sort of the narrative on that. I'm pleased to hear that you're, that's what you get from it, because that's part of the, part of the intention of the book. it does, you know, work with some wonderful people to help make it look as good as it does. You know, it's a team effort. Wonderful photographer, Sam Harris, who is, one of the best in the business. I'm pleased that that's jumping out of the book, that you're getting that vibe.
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised I never had the agnolotti with ricotta and asparagus sauce, because my mother used to find some way of using asparagus in every dish she served. I guess she didn't know about this one. Tim, it's been just absolutely wonderful talking to you. And
you too.
I expect you will have continuing success with your book as well as with your restaurant.
Oh, well, look, bless you. I really appreciate you taking the time and looking into it and asking the questions. It means a lot. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Have a great day. Get cooking from the book.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.